Greetings, everybody. Maybe I should say season's greetings since we're in mid-December, coming to a rapid close to 21 and getting ready for 2022. I hope you're ready for both. Always a busy but fun time of year. This is Nick DeOlias, episode 30 of the Far Middle Podcast. Who are we going to go with for our athletic sponsor namesake for episode 30? We're going to go with one of the greatest, I think the greatest goalie in the history of the National Hockey League, which is Martin Brodeur. So why would Martin Brodeur be worthy of episode 30, but also maybe more importantly, the tagline of the greatest goalie of all time? Well, you know, there's a number of different perspectives you can view it from, all of them sort of supporting the case. Three Stanley Cup championships, four Vezina trophies, and he sort of earned or achieved those four Vezina trophies at a time when two individuals by the name of Patrick Roy and Dominic Hasek were playing goal as well. Those two, I would also put them in the top five goaltenders of all time. So if you think about it, with Brodeur, Hasek, and Roy, you had three of the probably five greatest goalies in the history of the game all playing at the same time. So he had some stiff competition when you were looking sort of toward the Goalie of the Year award, but Brodeur came away with four of those titles. Rookie of the Year with the Calder. And he also won two gold medals in the Olympics for Team Canada. You also look at statistically what Brodeur amassed over his career. I mean, this guy, in terms of what he amassed, it feels like those types of numbers will never be broken again or achieved again. Very similar to what you see with older baseball statistics back in the early days of baseball with like career wins and complete games. So you look at Brodeur, his career wins as a goalie, 691. He's nine wins shy of 700 wins. I don't think we'll ever see that record broken in the NHL. 125 career shutouts, that's an all-time record. 24 playoff shutouts, that's a career record in the history of the NHL. And he's also the cumulative save all-time record holder, 28,000-plus cumulative saves. The other sort of neat record that Brodeur holds, and this is one of the sort of cooler records in all the sports, Brodeur also holds the all-time NHL record for number of goals that a goalie has scored. And that total, believe it or not, is three. So Brodeur scored three goals in his career, and that is an NHL record as well. He was such a good puck handler that the NHL basically ended up changing its rules. And I think that's always the sign of whenever you're looking for the greatest whatever in sports, if the sport changed its rules because of the individual, that's oftentimes a good indication that that was the best individual at a specific position within a specific sport. So if Bob Gibson was so dominating that they lowered mound height because of him, I'd consider him one of the, if not the greatest pitcher of all time. You know, if Mel Blunt was such a physical presence of a cornerback during the 70s in the NFL that it changed, the NFL changed the rules on contact when sort of defending receivers, it's probably a sign that Mel Blunt was one of the greatest, if not the greatest cornerback of all time. While the NHL did the same thing with puck handling and goalies because of Brodeur, that's a good indication. And Brodeur, he was the perfect guy for that neutral zone trap that the Devils used, that system they employed that was so effective in the 90s and 2000s. And I just think of the New Jersey Devils back in the day. I think of Martin Brodeur with those two Scots back there on defense, Scott Niedermeyer and Scott Stevens. And boy, Scott Stevens could lay out the hits when he wanted to. I just think of a couple of epic hits that he had in collisions with Eric Lindros. But those three, Brodeur and the two Scots, they perfected a system that won. Yeah, it was a boring system. It was workmanlike, but it wore down the opposition, and it was very effective. So Dominic Hasek, he might have been the more electric goalie. You know, he might have been more fun to watch if you're in the stands or on TV. And Patrick Roy may have enjoyed perhaps like a bigger brand, I would say, as the consummate goalie. Kids wanted to become goalies because of Patrick Roy. But Marty Brodeur, he just set records in a system that, again, I don't think we'll ever see broken down the road or broken again. And speaking of Martin Brodeur and the New Jersey Devils, I want to also give a shout out to Joe S. He's one of our constant listeners, a friend of the energy industry. Ran into him this past week. He's a northern New Jersey guy who became a Pittsburgh guy. So I suspect he might be a New Jersey Devils fan, but I hope Joe's doing well. Now, I hinted in the prior episode of the Far Middle that what I was going to spend some time discussing on episode 30 here was to focus some attention on the topics of a speech that I was able to deliver here the past week in Pittsburgh at a major energy conference. And the topics of the speech in the energy industry they link themselves, I think, nicely to Marty Brodeur. So think about the goalie in hockey. It's the foundation of a hockey team, right? If you don't have goaltending, you're not going to have a Stanley Cup. It's a prerequisite, not just to be successful, but to win the ultimate championship in sport. And energy is the foundation of not a team, but of society, you know, the economy. It's the foundation of the region, my region that I live within, and wider regions within this nation and the world across the globe. So if you don't have a strong domestic energy industry, then you're not going to have any of those things either. You're not going to have a well-functioning society, a strong economy, and a thriving region. So goalies in hockey are sort of equivalent to the importance of energy to, as I said, society, economy, region, quality of life. And Brodeur's greatness was in part due to his, what I mentioned earlier, his workmanlike approach. So again, this wasn't the flashiest of guys. He wasn't a me first guy. He was in the net. He did his job. Team came first. And that to me sounds a lot like descriptors of all the great people of domestic energy and all the great people of domestic energy in Appalachia, including, of course, Western Pennsylvania. And the speech that I gave not only dealt with energy, but it was constructed, I think, in a way to connect those dots that we love to connect each episode of the Far Middle podcast. You know, it's no secret, obviously, that I see domestic energy as a crucial, I think the crucial bedrock foundation of our economy and national security and quality of life. So if we lose domestic energy, we lose those things. We get domestic energy right, we get those things and enjoy them in a big and outsized way. And that's not just my opinion or my view, that's the reality. I mean, that's been proven time and time again, not just within the United States during different periods of history, but all across the globe, as long as there's been civilization and economies and industry. So what I wanted to do was to deliver a message that laid out who is important. So, you know, who are the stakeholders? And I always wince when I use the term stakeholder. I joke with a lot of people on the team or around me that that's one of those squishy words I try to avoid, but sometimes I guess it's appropriate. So who are those stakeholders that are most important? What are the types of things, or who are the types of entities that are aligned against those important individuals that are near and dear to our hearts and critical to our success? And also, you know, spend some time on talking about what's not working. Who's aligned against them? What isn't working? What needs to be improved? How do we make this situation better so that domestic energy comes out on top and all the subsequent benefits that will flow from it? And when doing that, I thought it was important to wrap the topic and the talk itself with at least a general proposal. Again, not all the details figured out, but a general proposal as to what would work in terms of a social contract or an agreement between industry, the region, all the different entities that are involved and affected by it one way or another. What could we propose in the form of, again, social contract, so to speak, that would put everybody at a better place? So the dots in that speech were linked to the audience that we were trying to get this message to and why they were so important, to talking a little bit about the opposition that's out there to domestic energy and how to think about them and where they're coming from. Also, I think a message to the leadership, or sometimes the lack thereof when it comes to leadership in this region and in our energy industry, domestic energy industry, that's desperately needed. So we desperately need leadership, but sometimes we don't get it. Why might that be the case? And then, as I said, a new proposal of a social contract that would benefit domestic energy, but also benefit all the people and entities within, say, the region of Appalachia, within our country, across a wider geographical scope, and frankly, billions of people the world over. Whenever you give a talk or a speech, I guess the experts always tell you to first think about who your target audience is, who you're trying to message to. And for me, I was really trying to message to broad groups, really important categories of entities and individuals. First were the people of Appalachia broadly. So this could be Pennsylvania, it could be obviously Ohio, West Virginia, upstate New York, Western Virginia, but that geographic footprint. But within that geographic footprint, I'd call it three subcategories of entities. The first were business owners. These could be small businesses, huge businesses, it doesn't matter. But we've talked about this so many times in the past on the Far Middle. Businesses, business owners create value in the free market. They're competing every day to make payroll. They're improving society. They are the exemplars of why capitalism, despite it not being perfect, capitalism works. And Milton Friedman was right about a lot of things. Also, besides business owners, another sort of subcategory within the people of Appalachia I was speaking to and always am interested in trying to message to is the middle class. You know, like businesses, we've talked about this before, middle class, probably the singular most important thing that made this country great. Something, unfortunately, that's methodically being eroded at times, and at times that's an intentional erosion by the hard left or elite academia, right? Environmentalism could be the administrative state. Those things seem to be working against the middle class. So speaking up for them or to them is always an important thing from my perspective. And then the third sort of subgroup within the people of Appalachia, those neighbors of ours who are living in underserved zip codes, specifically here, kids, young adults, whether it's urban, rural, those zip codes that are underserved, that are looking to catapult themselves to sort of the promised land of the middle class, but they just face this resistance and these obstacles more and more. Sometimes it's from government policy. Sometimes it might be, you know, from a system that feels that it's designed to keep them from arriving to that promised land that I just spoke about, whether it's self-sufficiency, opportunity, fulfilling career paths. That's another key target audience for me that I'm always thinking about trying to reach. And then I'm also, you know, thinking about always trying to message to the people of the energy industry. And here I'm talking about the real energy industry. So I'm talking about natural gas, domestic oil, pipelines, petrochemicals, all the legit tangible stuff, not the make-believe energy industry of, you know, whether it's so-called renewables or things that are built off a subsidy or, you know, the zero carbon mythology. So I'm talking about the people that are out there doing every day, performing, achieving every day. A lot of these individuals didn't miss a beat during COVID. They went out and worked every single day through COVID because they had to. They were just that vital to society. And this could be younger people starting out their careers in the energy industry, or it could be the leaders of the energy industry. And sometimes those leaders aren't necessarily the C-suite executives. These leaders could just be sort of the unofficial informal leaders, but everybody knows that these are the ones that you want to be with when the you-know-what hits the fan. And they view what many of us perceive as problems as being opportunities. They're running to the problems because they look at them as opportunities, and we recognize that and are always looking to them as leaders. And I spent some time, I allocated a significant amount of time because it's a really important issue, to talk in a little more detail about the opposition to domestic energy, the opposition to, say, the people of Appalachia or the people within the domestic energy space. And when you look at natural gas and domestic oil and the pipeline industry and power generation in the instance of combined cycle power plants and petrochemicals and hooking up businesses or new home housing developments to natural gas, when you look at us effectively, that's basically the domestic energy industry in a nutshell. There is obviously opposition, but we tend to think of the opposition as a singular homogeneous group, and it's not. We shouldn't sort of stereotype it as such, because when you think it through, there are basically three broad categories of the opposition, the elite critic class at times or oftentimes that's out there to oppose domestic energy. And in the first sort of category of the opposition, there sits the entities that want to use, you know, some type of manufactured fear or a concern with what domestic energy is all about, and to use that manufactured fear or concern to justify creating rules and regulations, in some instances markets, to basically make money off of. So these entities, sometimes they can be massive corporations, multi-billion dollar corporations, but they're using mandates and tax credits to build wind farms to nowhere. And we're all aware of that occurring on massive scales across this nation and world. Sometimes the entities can be universities and their research arms, where they're out there spending, procuring billions of our taxpayer dollars, and they're going to go spend that on studies aimed to tackle climate change or some such nonsense. And sometimes you see more and more of this. These entities can be global certification and trading platforms that are setting up some sort of market or process where they're basically skimming a little off the top as a fee. Now, all these entities, no matter which example there you pick in this first group of opposition, they're basically engaging in a form of what George Washington Plunkett back in Tammany Hall, the politician from Tammany Hall days in corrupt old New York City, used to call or reference honest graft. And honest graft is basically building and using a constructed problem to justify a solution, and that solution is going to create subsidy or protected market for the entities that are looking to just simply make money. They don't really hate us so much in domestic energy, this first opposition group, that is. For this first opposition group, it's not, you know, about hate or dislike. It's about business. It's about the business of finding an excuse, a rationale to take a dollar from you or from us and to put it indirectly into their pockets. So if you think through what they're doing in this sort of first group of the opposition, it's capitalism, but it's capitalism by wealth redistribution and by controlled markets versus what we do, right, in domestic energy and what a true doer will accomplish, which is capitalism, practices capitalism by innovation and by free markets. So it's a different form of capitalism, I think a less superior form for sure, but nevertheless, that's sort of the essence of what they're doing. Now, in the second group of opposition to domestic energy, here you've got something a little bit different than the first group. Here in the second group, you've got entities who are looking to paint us in a poor light or as a problem that needs fixed or protected from. But why are they doing that? They're doing that to justify more revenue or authority to feed whatever bureaucracy or institution is basically hungry and needs fed more. And as we've discussed many, many times on prior episodes of The Far Middle, these appetites from these entities can oftentimes be voracious. They're never ending. They're always getting larger and larger. So, you know, this quest, this drive never stops. And of course, government's the biggest example that falls into this category. And it can be state governments. Pennsylvania, my home state, no different there. It fits the mold. It looks to tax domestic energy in state. And then it wants to use those proceeds to do everything from funding, you know, gaps in pension funds to feed the government bureaucracy or to just keep certain government favored programs going. It could, of course, be our federal government. We're seeing more and more of that with the current administration, whether it's methane fees or carbon taxes. And again, what's the federal government going to be after? Well, they're doing this first and foremost in the end, when it's all said and done, you sort of peel away the veneer of the marketing. They're doing it to plug budget deficit spending, which is getting more and more large. It's massive, growing by the quarter. And it's also needed, right? More revenue is also needed to service what is now rapidly approaching pretty soon here, $30 trillion in federal debt. And then increasingly, we can see the second group of opposition also being global governments. And when I say global governments here, I'm sort of referencing these climate accords and all the money flows that you see being tied to them. And those money flows are going back and forth, you know, from one nation to the next. And it's basically a big circular game of wealth appropriation to plug unsustainable fiscal gaps. What happened in Glasgow recently at the UN climate meeting was a great example of this, a huge example of it. And what you typically see there is all kinds of posturing that basically spews very little tangible, very little logic. But I joked, it spews an awful lot of carbon dioxide. It's probably true when you look at the actual carbon footprints that this elite class sort of practices when they go to places like Glasgow to spew all that carbon dioxide and wordsmithing, but no logic and nothing tangible. So this group, the second group, you know, they may say they dislike us, and oftentimes you hear that. I don't think most of them do truly dislike us. I think at heart, whether it's the politician, whether it's the bureaucrat, look, they're just looking for opportunity. They're going to shift to match whatever prevailing wind of opportunity is blowing at that time. It's really about the dollars and balancing budgets. And when you get bigger budgets and bigger, more dollars, you got more power in politics and in the administrative state itself. Saving a planet, atmospheric CO2 in 50 years, that banner of serving the public good, all that stuff is pretense. That's the thin veneer of the marketing. Now, the third and final opposition group to domestic energy, here you're going to find that true believer, that religious zealot, the oppressive extremist who's going to be worshiping at the altar of climate. They're going to be placing the earth ahead of the human, right? You're going to see that the collective becomes more important than the individual. Ideology supersedes math and science. You're going to see all that happening. And here, unlike the prior two subgroups of opposition, for this third group, it is not about money. It's not about, you know, budget gaps and finding ways to fund them. It's about eradicating domestic energy and what it does in any region that drives domestic energy. And certainly Appalachia and a whole bunch of other regions across the United States would fall into that category. What they want is domestic energy killed off. If there's collateral damage or consequences, so what? That's a small price to pay, because what you're dealing with is an evil from your perspective that needs to be destroyed. And here, I think the hate is legit. The vilification is real. These are where you hear the outrageous claims coming from, typically about domestic energy. So these are the ones that are saying domestic energy poisons kids and it destroys the planet and it oppresses the poor. Pretty nasty stuff, and pretty nasty stuff and wild accusations that typically face no consequences. And I wouldn't take this group lightly or try to think that you can negotiate a reason with them. It's often going to be a win-lose proposition. And the conflict and fight, they're not going to go away. You can try to run from them, but at some point, and probably some point soon, you're going to have to face that that fight head on. So appeasement, I wouldn't recommend it here. It didn't work for Neville Chamberlain in the 1930s. I don't think it's going to work well here either. And that's just the way that I see that sort of third subgroup of the opposition to us, which is, again, a little bit of a different dynamic going on than the first two opposition groups. So what I ended up doing in this talk is proposing a new, as I referenced earlier, social contract proposal where domestic energy in Appalachia, just as the example that I was most familiar with and most pertinent for the talk itself, would offer up or consider, let's say, four ways that we could up the game of domestic energy in the Appalachian Basin, and sort of four gives, I would call them, in exchange that would benefit all the individual entities in Appalachia. And then in return, we would ask for four gets. And these four gives and four gets together would sort of catapult not just the domestic energy industry in Appalachia, and not just Appalachia in total, but a whole bunch of other, you know, beneficiaries beyond Appalachia, would catapult it to a new level of performance, enjoyment, et cetera. And on the give side, I talked through four of these, as I said, and they dealt with things like tax revenue, frankly. Thinking through, in the state of Pennsylvania, which was the example I used, there's an impact fee in place. It's been there for 10 years. Cumulatively, it exceeded $2 billion of payments to the state over 10 years this past summer, which has been a massive benefit to a whole bunch of different beneficiary entities in the state of Pennsylvania. But thinking about when that was originally implemented and what the industry was like and what it's like today, 10 years later, it's time for a refresh. And I think if we being the wider region, could be political leadership, could be regulatory entities within government, could of course be the industry itself, everybody and everyone, if we got together and thought through about what a new sort of design would be of this type of an impact fee for a 2022 world moving forward based on what we know today versus what we knew 10 years ago, we could probably come up with a methodology and approach where not only does the industry, the domestic energy industry in Pennsylvania, thrive more, but you also increase net the revenues that you would see or that the state would enjoy relative to how the current impact fee is structured. And I'd be really interested in getting together with different sort of thought leaders or individuals in the region to figure that out and see if there's any promise there. Another idea of stepping up our game as an industry on that give side dealt with environmental reporting. And increasingly, I'm sort of falling out on the fence or the side of, when it comes to environmental reporting, the accuracy, transparency, timeliness of that reporting in an industry like natural gas is crucial. And if we want to borrow something that we know that works, and in this instance, I'm talking about public corporations and how they report financial results, right, to the SEC and to the investor community, the capital markets, the publicly traded markets, there's a very well-defined process and rigor that goes along with it to assure timely and accurate financial statements. We can simply copy and paste that type of a process to one where we're reporting our environmental performance, whether it's emissions or that type of data for everything from permits to sort of quarterly and annual reports that are required. And that increased transparency, accuracy, timeliness, and the assurance that goes with it, the rigor that goes into it, that makes all entities much more comfortable about what domestic energy is bringing to the table and, you know, how it impacts a whole bunch of different entities across the region. And then the third idea for upping the game and on the give side was looking at who we're hiring and how we're spending our dollars in this industry of domestic energy and within, say, Pennsylvania or Appalachia, and really focusing in on a commitment to allocate more and more of our hiring and more of our spend to individuals and companies that are from the regions that we operate within, sort of organic hiring, organic spend within our region, almost becoming geographically non-diverse, which is ironic because everybody is always, right, eager for more diversity. But geographically, this would lead to a less diverse geographic focus on employees and on spend. But if you target within that entities like the building trades, which I'm a big fan of, I've said that a number of times on prior podcast episodes, and you also target socioeconomically underserved communities, urban and rural, throughout Appalachia, then all of a sudden, you're almost statistically certain that diverse physical diversity is going to improve across domestic energy and its industry as well, which of course would be a great thing. And then the fourth and final idea sort of put out there for discussion was taking sort of a leading stance as an industry on plugging thousands of abandoned wells in the Appalachian region. So Appalachia has a very long-lived domestic energy history, right? Whether it's coal, natural gas, oil, the oil well, the first oil well in the world was basically drilled in Appalachia in Pennsylvania. And through decades and decades and decades, 100 plus years, there's wells that basically have been abandoned, whether the companies or the prior operators have gone bankrupt, whatever the case might be. And you add them all up, there's thousands of them across this region. Now, that's not a problem that the current energy industry caused. Definitely wasn't a cause of it. And that's not something that an individual company or entity that's currently active in domestic energy is responsible for. These are abandoned wells. Nobody knows who they're responsible for in many instances. But what does leadership look like, right, for an industry? It probably looks like leading on removing that risk by identifying those wells, helping to get them plugged so that everybody in the community and the region would benefit. So those were the four gives, upping the game of domestic energy in Appalachia. On the get side, I also came up with four proposed items that we could request, demand, whatever you'd want to call it, to sit with, to balance the four that I just mentioned. And what was interesting about these four, right, the prior four that I just laid out were very tangible, very discrete. You could be able to measure them before, after, and see what type of progress. You can quantify them. These four are more general. And you could argue that we shouldn't even be asking for acknowledgement of these things because they reflect truth and science and reason. I mean, this is just basic common sense. But nevertheless, I think domestic energy should be demanding these four things to couple with those four prior gives that I just covered. And you couple them together, right? That forms sort of the social contract. If you don't have the gets, then you don't have the gives, and you don't come to sort of a middle ground or an understanding. And the first idea is an acceptance by everybody that every form of energy and every economic endeavor in a city or a state, region, nation, world, everything has a carbon footprint. There's no such thing as zero carbon for scopes 1 through 3, net or gross, today or tomorrow, and certainly not wind or solar. They are not zero carbon. And this is, again, a scientific fact. We've talked about this before. I think it's time for anyone who wants to voice an opinion when it comes to energy policy to acknowledge it, or you have to begin to just, you know, tune them out or ignore them as someone that just either doesn't want to know or knows and wants to sort of cloud the fact with the fantasy. Second idea was streamlining and supporting, and I mean actually supporting, things like pipeline construction and things like natural gas combined cycle power generation and residential natural gas hookups and more petrochemical industry, right? More natural gas demand. It's good for a whole bunch of things. It's good for jobs. It's good for climate because it's displacing things like coal. It's good for GDP. It's good for business owners. And it's good for basically government revenues, whether it's impact fees and severance tax or payroll tax. So politicians and bureaucrats, they should be aligned with this. They should get this. And if they're not aligned, then something other than the science in the best interests of the constituents that they represent is taken priority, which of course wouldn't be a good thing. The third sort of proposed ask was for the leaders in industry and politics and academia within, say, Pennsylvania or Appalachia or areas that are drivers of domestic energy like those three, to take on the shrill voices in places like New York or Massachusetts. Those shrill voices, right, what are they doing? They're vilifying domestic energy. They're trying to stop interstate commerce. And they're doing this under the false banner of, hey, we got to save the world and we're looking after the public good. So if you look at what's going on with Massachusetts, it could be the mayors of the big cities like Boston. It could be the senators down in D.C., like certain senators, and we know who those might be. And what they advocate for in Massachusetts, it's helping Putin and it's hurting Western Pennsylvania. And what Cuomo and de Blasio in New York wanted, and I joke that I can use the past tense, but I'm serious when I'm happy to say that I can use the past tense with those two now that they're out or on their way out, that's going to help China. That's going to hurt West Virginia or Ohio. And what President Biden and Congresswoman AOC, what they're clamoring for, that's helping socialism and the left. That's hurting Appalachia and the individual. So the leadership within this region and leadership in domestic energy, wherever it's coming from, it needs to defend the regions and the industry of domestic energy, its affiliated industry interests, when it's threatened by nonsensical attack, whether it's ideological attack or regulatory or financial attack. And then the fourth idea for something that we should demand if we're really interested in that audience that I outlined earlier and sort of science and reason, eliminating protected markets and eliminating subsidy for things like unreliable and expensive foreign wind and solar. We've talked about the huge carbon footprints that they have on a scope 1-3 basis. We've talked about how they make budget gaps for municipalities and school districts and states and countries worse, right? We've talked about how the middle class and the working poor bear the brunt of these costs of bad energy policy, both direct and indirect costs. And then we've talked about how all the material and most of the components for wind and solar, you're going to have to mine it, process it, manufacture it, not just out of state or out of region, but oftentimes offshore and oftentimes in places like China. So these wind and solar or so-called renewable mandates, they are just a losing proposition of larger carbon footprint and increased cost and outsourcing energy independence to typically nations that are applying human rights abuses like China. And I view it as a blunder, strategically a blunder, that really, you know, borders on the absurd when the United States is looking to implement policy that's going to outsource its energy independence to global rivals and then hope, right, that those rivals, soon to be perhaps enemies, aren't going to use it against this time and time again. So, you know, if you don't like the idea of blood diamonds or clothing made in sweatshops, if that stuff bothers you, because, you know, it certainly bothers me, then you're not going to like, you're going to absolutely hate the idea of wind and solar that are being made from the brutalization of dissidents and minorities in China. Now, these four gives and four gets that I just outlined, I think in total, they will help bring together the domestic energy industry and two of those three opposition groups that I spoke about. That Honest Graph crowd and the government crowd within those opposition groups, they see this and they see this proposed sort of give and get. I'm thinking a lot of them act rationally. They start to move to the middle where domestic energy can meet them. Again, not all of them, certainly not all of them, but I think a lot of them, not insignificant number would. So domestic energy moves closer to the center. They move in that opposition, those first two opposition groups closer to the center. Everybody wins, sort of conceptually, if you think about it, the far middle, interestingly enough. And when I was thinking through the topics for this speech and then obviously this podcast, I also want to give a shout out to one of our constant listeners who contacted me on Twitter. I get a lot of comments back and I welcome them all. Thank you all for doing that. But one of our constant listeners out there with the tagline, the cook from RuneScape on Twitter, you know, brought up the idea of, yeah, I get that, you know, environmentalism can be very destructive and oftentimes is that when you see it and hear about it out there today, what's your thoughts on responsible environmentalism? How could you do that right? And that was actually a catalyst to get me thinking about a lot of the content that I just covered here in this episode and in the speech itself that that was delivered this past week, particularly on those four gives that was proposed to up the game of domestic energy in places like Pennsylvania or Appalachia. I think that's about a wrap for episode 30 of The Far Middle. I hope you had a good time with this one. I'm going to try to post a video of that that speech or address that I spoke about at that energy conference here on the nickdeolias.com website soon. So check that out if you get a chance. It should be up in a couple of days or maybe a week. And we're getting closer to the publication date for Precipice, the book, get a chance, please pre-order it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Indie. And always on Twitter, at Nick Deolius. Love to hear back from you guys, like I often do. And always looking to post some thoughts here on a daily basis. And in the meantime, you got about a week or two before Christmas. So Santa Claus is coming. Get ready, put up that tree, string out those lights, and get in a good mood. I'll talk to you next week.